Shortly afterward, Sepha and Denver tried to call up and reason with the baby ghost, but got nowhere. It took a man, Paul D., to shout it off, beat it off, and take its place for himself. And carnival or no carnival, Denver preferred the venomous baby to him any day. During the first days after Paul D. moved in, Denver stayed in her emerald closet as long as she could, lonely as a mountain and almost as big, thinking everybody had somebody but her, thinking even a ghost's company was denied her. So when she saw the black dress with two unlaced shoes beneath it, she trembled with secret thanks. Whatever her power and however she used it, Beloved was hers. Denver was alarmed by the harm she thought Beloved planned for Sepha, but felt helpless to thwart it. So unrestricted was her need to love another. The display she witnessed at the clearing shamed her, because the choice between Sepha and Beloved was without conflict. Walking toward the stream, beyond her green bush house, she let herself wonder, what if Beloved really decided to choke her mother? Would she let it happen? Murder, Nelson Lord had said. Didn't your mother get locked away for murder? Wasn't you in there with her when she went? It was the second question that made it impossible for so long to ask Sepha about the first. The thing that leapt up had been coiled in just such a place. A darkness, a stone, and some other thing that moved by itself. She went deaf rather than hear the answer. And like the little 4 o'clocks that searched openly for sunlight, then closed themselves tightly when it left, Denver kept watch for the baby and withdrew from everything else. Until Paul D. came. But the damage he did came undone with the miraculous resurrection of Beloved. Just ahead, at the edge of the stream, Denver could see her silhouette, standing barefoot in the water, lifting her black skirts up above her calves, the beautiful head lowered in rapt attention. Blinking fresh tears, Denver approached her, eager for a word, a sign of forgiveness. Denver took off her shoes and stepped into the water with her. It took a moment for her to drag her eyes from the spectacle of Beloved's head to see what she was staring at. A turtle inched along the edge, turned, and climbed to dry ground. Not far behind it was another one, headed in the same direction. 4 placed plates under a hovering, motionless bowl. Behind her in the grass, the other one moving quickly, quickly to mount her. The impregnable strength of him, earthing his feet near her shoulders, the embracing necks, hers stretching up toward his, bending down, the pat, pat, pat of their touching heads. No height was beyond her yearning neck, stretched like a finger toward his, risking everything outside the bowl, just to touch his face. The gravity of their shields, clashing, countered and mocked the floating heads touching. Beloved dropped the folds of her skirt. It spread around her. The hem darkened in the water. Out of sight of Mr. Sight, away, praise his name, from the smiling boss of roosters, Paul D. began to tremble. Not all at once, and not so anyone could tell. When he turned his head, aiming for a last look at brother, turned it as much as the rope that connected his neck to the axle of a buckboard allowed, and later on, when they fastened the iron around his ankles and clamped the wrists as well, There was no outward sign of trembling at all. Nor 18 days after that, when he saw the ditches, the 1,000 feet of earth, 5 feet deep, 5 feet wide, into which wooden boxes had been fitted. A door of bars that you could lift on hinges like a cage opened into 3 walls and a roof of scrap lumber and red dirt. 2 feet of it over his head, 3 feet of open trench in front of him with anything that crawled or scurried, welcome to share that grave, calling itself quarters. And there were 45 more. He was sent there after trying to kill Brandywine, the man schoolteacher sold him to. Brandywine was leading him in a coffle with 10 others through Kentucky into Virginia. He didn't know exactly what prompted him to try, other than Hallie, 6-0, Paul A., Paul F., and Mister. But the trembling was fixed by the time he knew it was there. Still, no one else knew it, because it began inside, a flutter of a kind, in the chest, then the shoulder blades. It felt like rippling, gentle at first, and then wild, as though the further south they led him, the more his blood, frozen like an ice pond for 20 years, began thawing, breaking into pieces that once melted had no choice but to swirl and eddy. Sometimes it was in his leg. Then again it moved to the base of his spine. By the time they unhitched him from the wagon, and he saw nothing but dogs and 2 shacks in a world of sizzling grass, the roiling blood was shaking him to and fro. But no one could tell. The wrists he held out for the bracelets that evening were steady, as were the legs he stood on when chains were attached to the leg irons. But when they shoved him into the box and dropped the cage door down, his hands quit taking instruction. On their own they traveled. Nothing could stop them or get their attention. They would not hold his penis to urinate or a spoon to scoop lumps of lima beans into his mouth. The miracle of their obedience came with a hammer at dawn. All 46 men woke to rifle shot, all 46. 3 white men walked along the trench, unlocking the doors one by one. No one stepped through. When the last lock was opened, the 3 returned and lifted the bars one by one. And one by one, the black men emerged, promptly, and without the poke of a rifle butt, if they had been there more than a day. Promptly with the butt, if, like Paul D., they had just arrived. When all 46 were standing in a line in the trench, another rifle shot signaled the climb out and up to the ground above. Where 1,000 feet of the best hand-forged chain in Georgia stretched. Each man bent and waited. The first man picked up the end and threaded it through the loop on his leg iron. He stood up then and, shuffling a little, brought the chain tip to the next prisoner, who did likewise. As the chain was passed on and each man stood in the other's place, the line of men turned around, facing the boxes they had come out of. Not one spoke to the other, at least not with words. The eyes had to tell what there was to tell. Help me this morning. It's bad. I'ma make it. New man. Steady now. Steady. Chain up completed, they knelt down. The dew, more likely than not, was missed by then. Heavy sometimes, and if the dogs were quiet and just breathing, you could hear doves. Kneeling in the mist, they waited for the whim of a guard, or 2, or 3, or maybe all of them wanted it from one prisoner in particular, or none, or all. Breakfast? Want some breakfast, nigger? Yes, sir. Hungry, nigger? Yes, sir. Here you go. Occasionally, a kneeling man chose gunshot in his head as the price, maybe, of taking a bit of foreskin with him to Jesus. Paul D. did not know that then. He was looking at his palsied hands, smelling the guard, listening to his soft grunts, so like the doves, as he stood before the man, kneeling in mist on his right. Convinced he was next, Paul D. retched, vomited up nothing at all. An observing guard smashed his shoulder with the rifle, and the engaged one decided to skip the new man for the time being, lest his pants and shoes got soiled by nigger puke. Hi! It was the first sound, other than yes, sir, a black man was allowed to speak each morning, and the lead chain gave it everything he had. Hi! It was never clear to Paul D. how he knew when to shout that mercy. They called him High Man, and Paul D. thought at first the guards told him when to give the signal that let the prisoners rise up off their knees and dance two-step to the music of hand-forged iron. Later he doubted it. He believed to this day that the hi at dawn and the hoo when evening came were the responsibility High Man assumed because he alone knew what was enough, what was too much. When things were over, when the time had come. They chain danced over the fields, through the woods, to a trail that ended in the astonishing beauty of feldspar. And there Paul D.'s hands disobeyed the furious rippling of his blood and paid attention. With a sledgehammer in his hands and High Man's lead, the men got through. They sang it out and beat it up, garbling the words so they could not be understood, tricking the words so their syllables yielded up other meanings. They sang the women they knew, the children they had been, the animals they had tamed themselves or seen others tame. They sang of bosses and masters and misses, of mules and dogs, and the shamelessness of life. They sang lovingly of graveyards, and sisters long gone, of pork in the woods, meal in the pan, fish on the line, cane, rain, and rocking chairs. And they beat the women for having known them, and no more, no more. The children for having been them, but never again. They killed a boss so often and so completely, they had to bring him back to life to pulp him one more time. Tasting hot meal cake among pine trees, they beat it away. Singing love songs to Mr. Death, they smashed his head. More than the rest, they killed the flirt whom folks called life for leading them on, making them think the next sunrise would be worth it, that another stroke of time would do it at last. Only when she was dead would they be safe. The successful ones, the ones who had been there enough years to have maimed, mutilated, maybe even buried her, kept watch over the others who were still in her cock-teasing hug, caring and looking forward, remembering and looking back. They were the ones whose eyes said, help me, spad, or look out, meaning, this might be the day I bay or eat my own mess or run. It was this last that had to be guarded against. For if one pitched and ran, all 46 would be yanked by the chain that bound them, and no telling who or how many would be killed. A man could risk his own life, but not his brother's. So the eyes said, steady now, and hang by me. 86 days and done. Life was dead. Paul D. beat her butt all day every day, till there was not a whimper in her. 86 days, and his hands were still, waiting serenely each rat-rustling night for hi at dawn, and the eager clench on the hammer's shaft. Life rolled over dead, or so he thought. It rained. Snakes came down from shortleaf pine and hemlock. It rained. Cypress, yellow poplar, ash and palmetto drooped under 5 days of rain without wind. By the eighth day, the doves were nowhere in sight. By the ninth, even the salamanders were gone. Dogs laid their ears down and stared over their paws. The men could not work. Chain-up was slow. Breakfast abandoned. The two-step became a slow drag over soupy grass and unreliable earth. It was decided to lock everybody down in the boxes till it either stopped or lightened up so a white man could walk, damn it, without flooding his gun and the dogs could quit shivering. The chain was threaded through 46 loops of the best hand-forged iron in Georgia. It rained. In the boxes, the men heard the water rise in the trench and looked out for cottonmouths. They squatted in muddy water, slept above it, peed in it. Paul D. thought he was screaming. His mouth was open and there was this loud, throat-splitting sound. But it may have been somebody else. Then he thought he was crying. Something was running down his cheeks. He lifted his hands to wipe away the tears and saw dark brown slime. Above him, rivulets of mud slid through the boards of the roof. When it come down, he thought, gonna crush me like a tick bug. It happened so quick he had no time to ponder. Somebody yanked the chain once, hard enough to cross his legs and throw him into the mud. He never figured out how he knew, how anybody did, but he did know, he did, and he took both hands and yanked the length of chain at his left, so the next man would know too. The water was above his ankles, flowing over the wooden plank he slept on, and then it wasn't water anymore. The ditch was caving in, and mud oozed under and through the bars. They waited. Each and every one of the 46, not screaming, although some of them must have fought like the devil not to. The mud was up to his thighs, and he held on to the bars. Then it came, another yank from the left this time, and less forceful than the first, because of the mud it passed through. It started like the chain up, but the difference was the power of the chain. One by one, from high man back on down the line, they dove, down through the mud under the bars, blind, groping. Some had sense enough to wrap their heads in their shirts, cover their faces with rags, put on shoes. Others just plunged, simply ducked down and pushed out, fighting up, reaching for air. Some lost direction, and their neighbors, feeling the confused pull of the chain, snatched them around. For one lost, all lost. The chain that held them would save all or none, and Highman was the delivery. They talked through that chain like Sam Morse, and great God, they all came up, like the unshriven dead, zombies on the loose, holding the chains in their hands. They trusted the rain and the dark, yes, but mostly Highman and each other. Past the sheds where the dogs lay in deep depression, past the two guard shacks, past the stable of sleeping horses, past the hens whose bills were bolted into their feathers, they waded. The moon did not help because it wasn't there. The field was a marsh, the track a trough. All Georgia seemed to be sliding, melting away. Moss wiped their faces as they fought the live oak branches that blocked their way. Georgia took up all of Alabama and Mississippi then, so there was no state line to cross, and it wouldn't have mattered anyway. If they had known about it, they would have avoided not only Alfred and the beautiful feldspar, but Savannah too, and headed for the Sea Islands on the river that slid down from the Blue Ridge Mountains. But they didn't know. Daylight came, and they huddled in a copse of redbud trees. Night came, and they scrambled up to higher ground, praying the rain would go on shielding them and keeping folks at home. They were hoping for a shack, solitary, some distance from its big house, where a slave might be making rope or heating potatoes at the grate. What they found was a camp of sick Cherokee, for whom a rose was named. Decimated but stubborn, they were among those who chose a fugitive life rather than Oklahoma. The illness that swept them now was reminiscent of the one that had killed half their number 200 years earlier. In between that calamity and this, they had visited George III in London, published a newspaper, made baskets, led Oglethorpe through forests, helped Andrew Jackson fight Creek, cooked maize, drawn up a constitution, petitioned the King of Spain, been experimented on by Dartmouth, established asylums, wrote their language, resisted settlers, shot bear, and translated scripture. All to no avail. The forced move to the Arkansas River, insisted upon by the same president they fought for against the Creek, destroyed another quarter of their already shattered number. That was it, they thought, and removed themselves from those Cherokee who signed the treaty in order to retire into the forest and await the end of the world. The disease they suffered now was a mere inconvenience compared to the devastation they remembered. Still, they protected each other as best they could. The healthy were sent some miles away. The sick stayed behind with the dead to survive or join them. The prisoners from Alfred, Georgia, sat down in a semicircle near the encampment. No one came, and still they sat. Hours passed, and the rain turned soft. Finally, a woman stuck her head out of her house. Night came, and nothing happened. At dawn, two men, with barnacles covering their beautiful skin, approached them. No one spoke for a moment. Then High Man raised his hand. The Cherokees saw the chains and went away. When they returned, each carried a handful of small axes. Two children followed with a pot of mush cooling and thinning in the rain. Buffalo men, they called them, and talked slowly to the prisoners, scooping mush and tapping away at their chains. Nobody from a box in Alfred, Georgia, cared about the illness the Cherokee warned them about. So they stayed, all 46, resting, planning their next move. Paul D. had no idea of what to do and knew less than anybody, it seemed. He heard his co-convicts talk knowledgeably of rivers and states, towns and territories. Heard Cherokee men describe the beginning of the world and its end. Listened to tales of other buffalo men they knew, three of whom were in the healthy camp a few miles away. High Man wanted to join them. Others wanted to join him. Some wanted to leave, some to stay on. Weeks later, Paul D. was the only buffalo man left, without a plan. All he could think of was tracking dogs, although High Man said the rain they left in gave that no chance of success. Alone, the last man with buffalo hair among the ailing Cherokee, Paul D. finally woke up and, admitting his ignorance, asked how he might get north, free north, magical north, welcoming, benevolent north. The Cherokee smiled and looked around. The flood rains of a month ago had turned everything to steam and blossoms. That way, he said, pointing. Follow the tree flowers, he said. Only the tree flowers. As they go, you go. You will be where you want to be when they are gone. So he raced from dogwood to blossoming peach. When they thinned out, he headed for the cherry blossoms, then magnolia, chinaberry, pecan, walnut, and prickly pear. At last, He reached a field of apple trees, whose flowers were just becoming tiny knots of fruit. Spring sauntered north, but he had to run like hell to keep it as his traveling companion. From February to July, he was on the lookout for blossoms. When he lost them and found himself without so much as a petal to guide him, he paused, climbed a tree on a hillock, and scanned the horizon for a flash of pink or white in the leaf world that surrounded him. He did not touch them or stop to smell. He merely followed in their wake, a dark, ragged figure guided by the blossoming plums. The apple field turned out to be Delaware, where the weaver lady lived. She snapped him up as soon as he finished the sausage she fed him, and he crawled into her bed crying. She passed him off as her nephew from Syracuse, simply by calling him that nephew's name. 18 months, and he was looking out again for blossoms, only this time he did the looking on a dray. It was some time before he could put Alpha Georgia, 6-0, school teacher, Hallie, his brothers, Setha, Mister, the taste of iron, the sight of butter, the smell of hickory, notebook paper, one by one, into the tobacco tin lodged in his chest. By the time he got to 124, nothing in this world could pry it open. She moved him. Not the way he had beat off the baby's ghost, all bang and shriek, with windows smashed and jelly jars rolled in a heap, but she moved him nonetheless. And Paul D. didn't know how to stop it because it looked like he was moving himself. Imperceptibly, downright reasonably, he was moving out of 124. The beginning was so simple. One day, after supper, he sat in the rocker by the stove, bone-tired, river-whipped, and fell asleep. He woke to the footsteps of Setha coming down the white stairs to make breakfast. "I thought you went out somewhere," she said. Paul D. moaned, surprised to find himself exactly where he was the last time he looked. "Don't tell me I slept in this chair the whole night." Setha laughed. "Me, I won't say a word to you. Why didn't you rouse me?" "I did. Called you 2 or 3 times. I gave it up around midnight, and then I thought you went out somewhere." He stood, expecting his back to fight it, but it didn't. Not a creak or a stiff joint anywhere. In fact, he felt refreshed. Some things are like that, he thought. Good sleep places. The base of certain trees here and there, a wharf, a bench, a rowboat once, a haystack usually, not always bed, and here, now, a rocking chair, which was strange, because in his experience, furniture was the worst place for a good sleep. The next evening he did it again, and then again. He was accustomed to sex with Setha just about every day. And to avoid the confusion Beloved's shining caused him, he still made it his business to take her back upstairs in the morning or lie down with her after supper. But he found a way and a reason to spend the longest part of the night in the rocker. He told himself it must be his back, something supportive it needed for a weakness left over from sleeping in a box in Georgia. It went on that way. And might have stayed that way, but one evening, after supper, after Setha, he came downstairs, sat in the rocker, and didn't want to be there. He stood up and realized he didn't want to go upstairs either. Irritable and longing for rest, he opened the door to Baby Suggs's room and dropped off to sleep on the bed the old lady died in. That settled it, so it seemed. It became his room, and Setha didn't object. Her bed, made for two, had been occupied by one for 18 years before Paul D. came to call. And maybe it was better this way, with young girls in the house, and him not being her true-to-life husband. In any case, since there was no reduction in his before-breakfast or after-supper appetites, he never heard her complain. It went on that way, and might have stayed that way, except one evening, after supper, after Setha, he came downstairs and lay on Baby Suggs's bed and didn't want to be there. He believed he was having house fits, the glassy anger men sometimes feel when a woman's house begins to bind them, when they want to yell and break something, or at least run off. He knew all about that, felt it lots of times, in the Delaware Weaver's house, for instance. But always he associated the house fit with the woman in it. This nervousness had nothing to do with a woman whom he loved a little bit more every day. Her hands among vegetables, her mouth when she licked a thread end before guiding it through a needle, or bit it in two when the seam was done. The blood in her eye when she defended her girls, and beloved was hers now, or any colored woman from a slur. Also, in this house fit, there was no anger, no suffocation, no yearning to be elsewhere. He just could not, would not, sleep upstairs, or in the rocker, or now in Baby Suggs's bed. So he went to the storeroom. It went on that way, and might have stayed that way, except one evening, after supper, after Setha, he lay on a pallet in the storeroom and didn't want to be there. Then it was the cold house, and it was out there, separated from the main part of 124, curled on top of two croaker sacks full of sweet potatoes, staring at the sides of a lard can, that he realized the moving was involuntary. He wasn't being nervous. He was being prevented. So he waited, visited Setha in the morning, slept in the cold room at night, and waited. She came, and he wanted to knock her down. In Ohio, seasons are theatrical. Each one enters like a prima donna, convinced its performance is the reason the world has people in it. When Paul D. had been forced out of 124 into a shed behind it, summer had been hooted off stage, and autumn, with its bottles of blood and gold, had everybody's attention. Even at night, when there should have been a restful intermission, there was none, because the voices of a dying landscape were insistent and loud. Paul D. packed newspaper under himself and over to give his thin blanket some help, but the chilly night was not on his mind. When he heard the door open behind him, he refused to turn and look. "What you want in here? What you want?" He should have been able to hear her breathing. "I want you to touch me on the inside part and call me my name." Paul D. never worried about his little tobacco tin anymore. It was rusted shut. So while she hoisted her skirts and turned her head over her shoulder the way the turtles had, he just looked at the lard can, silvery in moonlight, and spoke quietly. "When good people take you in and treat you good, you ought to try to be good back. You don't. Setha loves you, much as her own daughter, you know that." Beloved dropped her skirts as he spoke and looked at him with empty eyes. She took a step he could not hear and stood close behind him. "She don't love me like I love her. I don't love nobody but her." "Then what you come in here for?" "I want you to touch me on the inside part." "Go on back in that house and get to bed." "You have to touch me on the inside part, and you have to call me my name." As long as his eyes were locked on the silver of the lard can, he was safe. If he trembled like Lot's wife and felt some womanish need to see the nature of the sin behind him? Feel a sympathy, perhaps, for the cursing cursed? Or want to hold it in his arms, out of respect for the connection between them? He too would be lost. Call me my name. No. Please call it. I'll go, if you call it. Beloved. He said it, but she did not go. She moved closer, with a footfall he didn't hear, and he didn't hear the whisper that the flakes of rust made either as they fell away from the seams of his tobacco tin. So when the lid gave, he didn't know it. What he knew was that when he reached the inside part, he was saying, red heart, over and over again, softly, and then so loud it woke Denver. Then Paul D. himself, red heart, red heart, red heart. To go back to the original hunger was impossible. Luckily for Denver, looking was food enough to last. But to be looked at in turn was beyond appetite. It was breaking through her own skin to a place where hunger hadn't been discovered. It didn't have to happen often, because Beloved seldom looked right at her. Or when she did, Denver could tell that her own face was just the place those eyes stopped while the mind behind it walked on. But sometimes, at moments Denver could neither anticipate nor create, Beloved rested cheek on knuckles and looked at Denver with attention. It was lovely. Not to be stared at, not seen, but being pulled into view by the interested, uncritical eyes of the other. Having her hair examined as part of herself, not as material or a style. Having her lips, nose, chin caressed as they might be if she were a moss rose a gardener paused to admire. Denver's skin dissolved under that gaze and became soft and bright like the lisle dress that had its arm around her mother's waist. She floated near but outside her own body, feeling vague and intense at the same time, needing nothing, being what there was. At such times, it seemed to be Beloved who needed something, wanted something. Deep down, in her wide black eyes, back behind the expressionlessness, was a palm held out for a penny which Denver would gladly give her, if only she knew how, or knew enough about her. A knowledge not to be had by the answers to the questions Setha occasionally put to her. You disremember everything? I never knew my mother neither, but I saw her a couple of times. Did you never see yours? What kind of whites was they? You don't remember none? Beloved, scratching the back of her hand, would say she remembered a woman who was hers, and she remembered being snatched away from her. Other than that, the clearest memory she had, the one she repeated, was the bridge, standing on the bridge, looking down. And she knew one white man. Setha found that remarkable, and more evidence to support her conclusions, which she confided to Denver. Where'd you get the dress? Them shoes? Beloved said she took them. Who from? Silence, and a faster scratching of her hand. She didn't know. She saw them and just took them. Mm-hmm, said Setha, and told Denver that she believed Beloved had been locked up by some white man for his own purposes and never let out the door, that she must have escaped to a bridge or someplace and rinsed the rest out of her mind. Something like that had happened to Ella, except it was two men, a father and son, and Ella remembered every bit of it. For more than a year, they kept her locked in a room for themselves. You couldn't think up, Ella had said, what them two done to me. Setha thought it explained Beloved's behavior around Paul D., whom she hated so. Denver neither believed nor commented on Setha's speculations, and she lowered her eyes and never said a word about the cold house. She was certain that Beloved was the white dress that had knelt with her mother in the keeping room, the true-to-life presence of the baby that had kept her company most of her life. And to be looked at by her, however briefly, kept her grateful for the rest of the time when she was merely the looker. Besides, she had her own set of questions which had nothing to do with the past. The present alone interested Denver, but she was careful to appear uninquisitive about the things she was dying to ask Beloved. For if she pressed too hard, she might lose the penny that the held-out palm wanted, and lose, therefore, the place beyond appetite. It was better to feast, to have permission to be the looker, because the old hunger, the before-beloved hunger that drove her into Boxwood and Cologne for just a taste of life, to feel it bumpy and not flat, was out of the question. Looking kept it at bay. So she did not ask Beloved how she knew about the earrings, the night walks to the cold house, or the tip of the thing she saw when Beloved lay down or came undone in her sleep. The look, when it came when Denver had been careful, had explained things, or participated in things, or told stories to keep her occupied when Setha was at the restaurant. No given chore was enough to put out the licking fire that seemed always to burn in her. Not when they wrung out sheets so tight the rinse water ran back up their arms. Not when they shoveled snow from the path to the outhouse, or broke 3 inches of ice from the rain barrel, scoured and boiled last summer's canning jars, packed mud in the cracks of the hen house, and warmed the chicks with their skirts. All the while, Denver was obliged to talk about what they were doing, the how and why of it, about people Denver knew once or had seen, giving them more life than life had. The sweet-smelling white woman who brought her oranges and cologne and good wool skirts. Lady Jones, who taught them songs to spell and count by. A beautiful boy, as smart as she was, with a birthmark like a nickel on his cheek. A white preacher who prayed for their souls while Setha peeled potatoes and Grandma Baby sucked air. And she told her about Howard and Bugler, the parts of the bed that belonged to each, the top reserved for herself. That before she transferred to Baby Suggs's bed, she never knew them to sleep without holding hands. She described them to Beloved slowly, to keep her attention, dwelling on their habits, the games they taught her, and not the fright that drove them increasingly out of the house, anywhere, and finally far away. This day they are outside. It's cold, and the snow is hard as packed dirt. Denver has finished singing the counting song Lady Jones taught her students. Beloved is holding her arms steady while Denver unclasps frozen underwear and towels from the line. One by one, she lays them in Beloved's arms until the pile, like a huge deck of cards, reaches her chin. The rest, aprons and brown stockings, Denver carries herself. Made giddy by the cold, they return to the house. The clothes will thaw slowly to a dampness perfect for the pressing iron, which will make them smell like hot rain. Dancing around the room with Setha's apron, Beloved wants to know if there are flowers in the dark. Denver adds sticks to the stove fire and assures her there are. Twirling, her face framed by the neckband, her waist and the apron strings embrace, she says she's thirsty. Denver suggests warming up some cider while her mind races to something she might do or say to interest and entertain the dancer. Denver is a strategist now and has to keep Beloved by her side from the minute Setha leaves for work until the hour of her return, when Beloved begins to hover at the window, then work her way out the door, down the steps, and near the road. Plotting has changed Denver markedly. Where she was once indolent, resentful of every task, now she is spry, executing, even extending, the assignments Setha leaves for them, all to be able to say, "We got to," and "Ma'am said for us to." Otherwise, Beloved gets private and dreamy, or quiet and sullen, and Denver's chances of being looked at by her go down to nothing.